This is an ABC podcast.
Especially when I was a kid to grow up in the dam, my dad and all people used to work at the stock camp. They used to drink their water from there, from the dam.
That was then, but now Yulamu, a community northwest of Alice Springs, has just 18 months left of water. We're going to look into that. And we test drive electric vehicles at an old airport in regional New South Wales.
How do you program them to miss all the potholes out here?
Well, one of our plans for this facility is to build bad roads and to actually test for that.
It's going to become one of the largest driverless vehicle testing sites in the Southern Hemisphere. I'm Sinead Mangan and you're listening to Australia Wide. It's fair to say Australians are addicted to talking about property. As a nation, we're obsessed with buying homes, and as prices get higher and higher, we're working longer and harder to achieve that dream. But could the great Australian dream be coming to an end? Our reporter, Lachlan Bennett, caught up with some Tasmanians who'd rather rent for life than buy into the property obsession.
Sydney property prices are only going one way, up.
2021 saw the fastest annual growth in 22 years.
Median Sydney homes now worth $1.6 million, increasing at $1,000 a day.
Millions of people are scrimping and saving to achieve what is regarded as the great Australian dream. But 30-year-old town planner Eric Smith is not one of them.
I just kind of thought, well, instead of chasing that dream and committing myself to making $80,000 of savings over the next 10 years so that I could put a deposit on a house, I would just commit to renting forever.
Eric lives in the northern Tasmanian city of Launceston. The latest CoreLogic regional market update revealed that local unit prices grew 31% in the last 12 months, faster than any of the 25 largest non-capital regions in the country. In a place like that, Eric prefers to invest his savings in stocks rather than being sucked into Australia's property obsession.
It is disappointing that property does have such a preferred tax status. I think one of the ways to solve the housing crisis is just not to treat housing as an investment and to treat housing as a human right.
While some choose not to buy a home, Stuart Mansfield has little say in the matter.
It's just never been my... Not something for me. I couldn't afford to do that.
Stuart lives in Launceston's eastern suburbs and survives on a small carer's pension with his 12-year-old son. He accepts he will probably never own a home, but renting is not necessarily easier.
I only get close to $1,300. Even with rent assistance, the rent assistance wouldn't even be enough for me to live in a place like that. I just couldn't afford it. Landlords don't look at someone like me and think that I'd be a decent tenant. So I just think it's a lose-lose situation for me to even attempt to try and get private rental. I have in the past, and I've just been knocked back before I come here. A lot of the times I feel like we're shunned because we're renters. I don't know why. I mean, the people here where I live, we're really good people, decent people. We rent, yes, but I get the feeling a lot of what I see in news and stuff that we're looked down upon a lot of the time just because we're renters.
Stuart is searching for a new place to live after the owner of his property doubled the rent following the end of a housing affordability scheme. He can't afford to stay at his current place, and there's little other options around the city.
It's why I'll be living in my car, basically. I've tried my hardest in the days that I've had to find accommodation for myself in particular. And it just doesn't exist at the moment. You just can't find it.
Stuart is just one of many Australians feeling the burn of the country's red-hot housing market. But CoreLogic head of research, Eliza Owen, says there's signs the market will cool.
One thing would be to consider higher interest costs. I mean, that is the primary reason that property prices across Australia are starting to slow down. And for some people, if they've got a lot of savings, then that'll just mean a lower deposit hurdle. But for some people, it's also worth considering, even if a property price is cheaper, what does the monthly mortgage repayment look like in a higher interest rate environment? Because even where prices fall substantially, monthly mortgage costs could actually be higher off the back of those higher rates.
Eric believes housing needs to be more affordable, but there also needs to be more diversity in the types of properties available for renters and buyers.
A lot of the new subdivisions occurring kind of just replicate low density single dwellings with enormous yards. Some smaller dwellings on that kind of block is nice. I don't want a garden, and there's kind of me and my partner, and we would really like maybe two bedrooms and maybe a courtyard, but it's impossible to buy that outside the centre of the city. And there are loads of reasons why people would want access to diverse housing options all over the place, not just in the centre of Sydney and other capitals.
Eric Smith finishing that story from Lachlan Bennett about the great Australian dream.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Safe access to clean drinking water is a serious problem in remote Indigenous communities across the Northern Territory, where dwindling groundwater supplies have residents worried about the future of their homelands. Experts say that Yulamu, a community northwest of Alice Springs, has just 18 months left of water supply from its current source. While there's still no long-term solution, authorities are preparing for future emergencies. Saskia Mabin has this story.
Welcome to Yulamu community!
About 3 hours' drive from Alice Springs, more than 200 people live in the Indigenous community of Yulamu. Located in one of the most remote parts of the country, Yulamu has struggled with water security for a long time. The community dam was decommissioned more than 6 years ago after an outbreak of toxic blue-green algae. Since then, all of Yulamu's water has come from a small aquifer nearby, but that has an expiration date that's fast approaching. Local leader David Stafford is concerned about the future of his community.
We worry. Water, yeah, we worry. Yeah. Some people try to move out, you know. Nah, that's a good place, you know, for people. We can't move out. We can't go into more. No. We stay here. And a long time, we was talking about that 16-mile bore, put a pipeline, long time ago. Yeah, and we're still talking here today.
Still talking about another bore?
Yeah.
So how are you feeling? Are you feeling nervous at all?
Yeah, we're here. Yeah. I'm feeling nervous, yeah. Bit worried too, you know. Kids worrying about school, you know. For water, we need water. Good water.
My full name is David McCormick. My dad and all, like all people, used to work at the stock camp. They used to drink their water from there, from the dam.
My name's Rosina Stafford. I work as the teacher. We have a little bit problem with water. We need water from somewhere to come to your community. Yeah, I get worried because we got kids and old people. Water's really precious for us.
Did you grow up here in Yulamu?
Yep.
What was it like when you were a kid with the water?
We was drinking water from dam.
Do you think that there was more water when you were a kid?
Yep, there was more water. We had rain. People used to go to creek too to get water.
There are signs around Yulamu reminding residents of the precarious water situation and of what they can do to save the precious resource. In the local council office, photos of awards commending the community for its water-saving efforts are stuck up on the walls. But being frugal is not enough. In April, the NT's Parent Water Corporation announced the groundwater at Yulamu had hit an all-time low. It said crews would need to truck water to the community immediately. However, Senior Manager of Demand and Developer Services, Kylie Climie, said alterations to the two bores have given Parent Water more time to find a solution.
So it's definitely at a critical low, and yes, definitely as bad as it's ever been, but we have more knowledge now and it's not as bad as we thought. We expect that we will get another year and a half out of that aquifer.
Trucking water could one day soon be needed as an emergency short-term fix. It comes with a hefty price tag, but Parent Water are preparing for the worst.
Every truck of water we bring in is less stress on the groundwater system and can make that groundwater last a little bit longer. So it might be a tool in our toolbox down the track to stretch out the groundwater supply by supplementing with a truck or two or three a day. But we don't need it right now, no, but we're planning to be able to use it in case we one day do need it.
In Yulamu, 30 hydro panels produce up to 150 litres of clean drinking water a day by extracting humidity from the air using solar energy. Although the technology works, it's not widely used by Yulamu locals. The company that manufactures the hydro panels, Source Global, wants to expand and make the project more user-friendly by putting two panels on every Yulamu house. It estimates that would provide 10 litres of drinking water per house per day at a total cost for the community of $8,000 per month. Central Revenue Officer Robert Bartrop.
That, for us, at a total cost, is dramatically cheaper than trucking water or subsidising bottled water. It's dramatically cheaper than really kind of multi-million dollar projects to extend pipelines. And many of those things may be, you know, a long-term solution. But for us, the ability to extend a basic level of service for drinking water to those households virtually immediately.
Parent Water Corporation says it would be too expensive to use the hydro panels on a community-wide scale in Yulamu. Its crews are focused on finding a new groundwater supply close to the community before it's too late.
Saskia Mabin with that story from Yulamu, northwest of Alice Springs.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. Driverless cars and autonomous buses might be more suited to Silicon Valley than the winding roads of the Central Tablelands of New South Wales. But they're all being put to the test at an old airport just out of Cadal that is set to become one of the largest driverless vehicle testing sites in the Southern Hemisphere under a new plan unveiled by the state government today. Our reporter, Hugh Hogan, was on the scene and he even got to take a ride in some of these state-of-the-art vehicles.
Doors closing. We are about to start moving.
It's very quiet.
Yes, it's fully electric. In fact, in some of the deployments we've done in South Korea, we actually had to introduce a noise to the outside of the vehicle to warn people.
Andrew Mahaffey from HMI Technologies is taking me for a spin in his driverless shuttle bus.
Well, we're standing in what's called a Level 4 autonomous shuttle vehicle. That means that it can drive itself without any steering wheel or pedals in known areas. So we program it to take people places.
Are these in operation anywhere?
They're in what you'd call pilot deployments. So they're still under development, but they're advancing to the point where they will very soon be able to be used for things like first and last mile public transport services and things like that.
His company is one of many using this old airport near Kudal in central west New South Wales to test cutting-edge technology.
This facility is fantastic for us. We've had a really good time here over the last week doing all sorts of things with the vehicle that have been very difficult in other areas. So to be able to bring the vehicle here with a lot of space and a lot of opportunity to do things, it's really great.
This particular former airport was the birthplace of the company that became Rex Airlines. And now it's set to be the launch pad for the driverless industry in Australia, thanks to a new investment from the state government. Here's the Minister for Regional Transport and Roads, Sam Faraway.
This facility is already the leading autonomous vehicle facility in Australia.
So why is such a facility needed? Megan Sharkey is the acting head of the division that manages the facility within Transport for New South Wales.
It's really important. So there's only so much you can do in software environments. Then you need to physically test how it interacts on the road. And that's what we're here for. We are here to test the limits of that technology and put it through as much as we can before it goes onto the road. So this is really important. The facility is currently booked out for 2022. This will give us additional capabilities and additional capacity to service more of the industry.
So now that developers have their own playground to mess around in, how long will it be until we see driverless cars out on our roads?
Within the next 5 years, we will see, you know, some buses. We have someone here today with an autonomous sweeper that's already commercialized. We will see that on the road. So some of this you will see within the next 5 years. It's possible, but in certain conditions. When will we see an autonomous vehicle that can go anywhere, everywhere, in any condition, under any scenario? That's much further away because it's very difficult to program for anything and everything.
But you still might see some prototypes a lot sooner than that.
Yeah, it's a standard Ford Ranger. We've just added a sensor suite on top and a computing suite in the back. Adding our software, we just make it drive itself.
Sam Pfeiffer from Kinigital Australia has been taking his fully autonomous ute for laps around the airport all morning. And he's on the precipice of testing it on some public roads near the city of Dubbo very soon.
We are aiming to have the first test trials in autonomous mode by July.
This year?
Yeah.
Out on public roads, I guess?
Yeah, in public roads. Three places in Dubbo.
How big of a milestone is it to get to those sort of tests?
Oh, it's huge. We are the first ones, as far as I know, to do it in New South Wales.
So while we might be waiting a while for true driverless vehicles around regional Australia, I had just one more question for the people in charge of our country roads.
And just lastly, how do you program them to miss all the potholes out here?
Well, one of our plans for this facility is to build bad roads and to actually test for that.
Pretty exciting stuff. Megan Sharkey from Transport New South Wales, ending that story from Hugh Hogan. I think he enjoyed putting that together. With borders coming down and the travel industry ramping up, planes are once again taking to the skies and the demand for pilots is growing. Good news for travellers, but as more pilots take to the skies with commercial airlines, pressure is being felt in regional Australia, with one Royal Flying Doctor service base struggling to attract pilots to the outback to help ease the workload. Melanie Groves is in Charleville and has more.
Tucked away in the mulga trees of outback Queensland, there's a plane hangar that's existed since World War II. It's still a hive of activity, but it's now home to the Royal Flying Doctor Service, often labelled the key to the outback survival. But it's the pilots who keep the doctors and nurses in the air. And the Charleville senior base pilot, Elliot Johnston, says there's nothing he'd rather be doing.
Changed schools in grade 9 to aviation high in Brisbane, then started flying training when I was 14 for my 14th birthday, actually, and didn't look back from there.
Elliot flies across the outback, a workplace of 600,000 square kilometres, delivering doctors and nurses to remote clinics as well as responding to emergencies.
We're in Thargaminda one day and we got a phone call from a motorbike accident travelling pretty high speed on a property just north of Cunnamulla. So it's always that exciting thing of, you know, go, 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 pack up, clinic, do a flight plan. Where is it? Where are we going? We hadn't been there before either, so we had no information on the strip. So making all those logistical phone calls, figuring out where they are so we get in the plane and go, land a dirt strip that none of us had seen before, scoop this fellow out of the dirt, throw him on the plane and take him to Brisbane, and then fly home that evening so we catch the sunset on the way home. It's probably as exciting as it gets.
While many pilots found themselves out of work, furloughed or contemplating a career change after COVID-19 decimated the travel industry, the RFDS was offering jobs. But now the travel industry is starting to recover and recruit. Organisations like the Flying Doctors are receiving less applications.
It can be a little tricky getting people, you know, who have a life established in a major city to move out bush. You know, they may want to, but it just can be a little difficult with families and things to take with them as well. So we are struggling to find people that can come out. So at the moment, we're just sort of picking up the slack where we can. We do have a very strict set of fatigue rules, so we're not working any harder, but our structure to our roster is suffering a little bit. You know, we're not getting the standard two-day shifts, two-night shifts like we normally do. We're maybe doing a night here, a couple of days off, then two-day shifts and an RDO, then night shifts. The social life can take a bit of an impact, but at the moment, I've got a really good crew out here that are just happy to pick up the slack because they're all passionate about the RFDS and Southwest Queensland, that they, you know, they're just willing to get in and go.
For Southwest Queensland man Scott Shorten, without the RFDS, little towns like Yawa, some 1,000 kilometres inland from Brisbane, just would not exist.
Originally, it was my mother and two other ladies first for the Yarra apple fields out here for a small community. They organised getting the medical chest and for the Flying Doctor to visit, and that was in the late 1970s. And without them, you wouldn't have small towns like Yarra. a lot of people, as they get older, that have to leave just for the medical side. They've helped all my family at one time or another, and that includes my own kids, and even when my grandkids and all that have been out here, a couple of them had to get flown out.
Semi-retired opal miner Scott Shorten, ending that story from Melanie Groves in Charleville. And finally, we're going to head to the windy Abrolhos Islands in WA. When Ash Sutton realised the seaweed growing on his farm off the coast of Geraldton had a similar texture to lolly snakes, he started to think about his next business move. After 4 years and a lot of trial and error, he's about to launch two chewing products made from seaweed as a healthy, chewy snack. Joe Prendergast visited Ash Sutton at the shack he calls home on the Abrolhos.
Have a taste.
About that much?
Yeah, rip it off. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's got a, like a...
It's like a red lolly.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, eh? And then it's good texture.
And there's nothing artificial in that?
Nothing, mate.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it has some unique properties, which appeal to me. And
what are they?
When I do my little techniques with it, it has a very elastic feel to it, and hence I thought, shit, this will be good, and a little chewing snack, and to target the confectionery market as well as the chef's table.
And that is what you're going for. You were saying earlier that you really want to have seaweed as an alternative to lollies.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, this, I've spent the last 4 to 5 years growing about 8 varieties of seaweed out here. It's not very easy to grow it. Especially some of the varieties, because the water temperatures change, you get cold fronts come in that wipe out all your crop. It's pretty tricky. So this particular product lasted the longest for me, and I thought, well, I'm running out of checkbooks, so I've got to stick to one product. This is the one I've worked out how to grow. Therefore, this has got the unique properties, which when I do my little tricks with, it's exactly the same consistency as a snake, you know, like a lolly snake. A lolly gummy bear. And it's such a cool looking product. I thought, I won't refine it, I won't process it, and wouldn't it be good if that actually tasted like a lolly? It's got a bit of honey. I didn't want to use sugar. I know that the vegans won't like me because they don't eat honey, but it's got a little bit of honey from my farm in Greneth.
And there's a few other tricks to get it to look like that.
Yeah,
but there that's is. Your IP, isn't it? You're not going to divulge those secrets.
No, that's 4 years and a lot of checkbooks.
What variety is that you're growing?
It's a Spinosium, so it's a red algae. Yeah, so it's a red seaweed, basically.
Why did you choose to grow seaweed at the Abrolhos?
Abrolhos is pretty much, I live in Western Australia, so the particular type of seaweed I wanted to grow has a warmer water variety, and the Abrolhos Islands is in direct path of the Leeuwin Current, so it has a good temperature range for the type of seaweed, and the Abrolhos Islands is, I've got a lot of mates here in the commercial fishing industry, and spend a lot of time growing up here, and
sort of like coming home almost.
It's a lovely spot, and you're away from the riffraff, and so is the ocean. So the ocean out here is really pristine.
Actually growing it,
yep.
What's that process been like in terms of learning the best way to cultivate it, that sort of thing?
It's been pretty cool. It's for me, normally diving underwater is looking for fish or looking for other stuff, and I don't do that now. I don't see anything. I don't see fish. All I see is varieties of seaweed, and I've learnt so much underwater. It's pretty cool. It's like a big underwater garden. And after 4 years of diving, looking and getting seaweed, you sort of work out, hang on a minute, it's not growing so good here, and it only works under that amount of light and under that amount of coral. So you sort of work out, okay, this is how you've got to grow it. And it doesn't happen overnight.
Pretty amazing stuff. Abrolhos Island seaweed farmer Ash Sutton, and he was speaking there to our reporter Joe Prendergast. Now, this farmer has plenty of strings to his bow. He's also an interior designer that specialises in bars, and the bars he's designed in Hong Kong and Bangkok are literally out of this world. So I wonder how these seaweed lollies will go. They'll probably be a big hit after a game of netball. And that's all from the Australia Wide team for today. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.